Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Communication, It's Art and Soul. All right, today's class is all about listening, so I want to begin with a story. The story goes that a wife asks her husband, she says, please go to the corner grocery store and get a carton of milk, and if there are eggs, get six. He comes back 20 minutes later with six cartons of milk. She says, what are you doing? What happened? Why'd you get six cartons of milk? He says, because they had eggs. You see, listening is so important. If they have eggs, get six. If they have eggs, get six. Listening is so very important, and we get it wrong so often. And when I say we get it wrong, I mean we get it, you know, we don't get it right. It's hard to get it right. It's hard to get listening right. I want to begin with a quote. The quote is from King Solomon, and you can find it in your books. Let's see where we are. Let's see where we're at. This is in the books on page... Who's got it? Who's the first one to get it? I think it's page 41. King Solomon starts us off with some Solomonic wisdom about listening that I think we can all relate to. Ray, please read from Proverbs. Text 1, page 41. King Solomon says that if you respond before listening, it's folly and embarrassment. The obvious question is, how do you respond before listening? How is that even possible? How can you actually respond before listening? Nu, help me out here. How do you respond before listening?
It's more important to you to say something than it is for them to listen. It is for you to listen.
Right. In other words, and I was about to jump in, but I figured I would listen to what you're saying. At least we should model the behavior in this class. Right, so exactly. Oftentimes, somebody's talking, and we're not even listening. We're already formulating the response and responding. We're already, but wait, I've got something to share. Forget about you. Here's what I want to say. Here's what I need to say. That's called, in the language of King Solomon, the language of Proverbs, Mishle, Meshiv Davar B'Terem Yishma, responding before listening. And he says it's a folly and an embarrassment. Two different things. Number one, it's a folly because you're making a mistake. It's foolish. It's foolish to not listen to the other person before you begin answering. How are you answering if you're not listening? How are you responding before actually listening to what the other is saying? Number one. And number two, when you recognize that the person may have meant something else or may have more to say and you totally missed the point, then it's embarrassing. Then it's like, oh, remember when I responded the way I responded? I wasn't really listening. So here's a new answer based on the fact that I'm listening to you now. And so that's a little bit embarrassing. So King Solomon warns us of the danger of speaking before listening. Last week we spoke about communication. And what we said is that to communicate is to do much more than just exchange ideas like the dictionary would have you believe. It's not just exchanging ideas, it's sharing oneself. It's revealing, it's expressing yourself to someone else. Well, you cannot express yourself to someone else if they're not listening. I mean, you can, but it doesn't really work. Because to reveal yourself to another implies that there's an actual acceptance of that revelation, if you will. You with me on this? In other words, if it's about expressing yourself, how can you express yourself, or how is it defined as expressing yourself if the other one is checking their email? Right? You have something important to say, and the other person's like, so you must have felt really bad about that. Cool. Huh, the Steelers are winning again. Right? Yeah. The Steelers are not winning. They're out of the playoffs. We're now dating this class. Okay, so the point is like this. The point is to have communication, proper communication, necessitates not only that there's a communicator, but someone to also receive the communication in a healthy fashion. And that requires healthy listening. That's a key component to the whole idea of communication. And by the way, listening is far different than just hearing. Hearing is, let's take a look at text number 2. Page 42. Susan.
Me?
Yeah.
To help you with congregation.
No. Text number 2, page 42.
Hearing takes place when something disturbs the atmosphere, and that disturbance takes the form of pressure waves that strike our eardrums as sound. It's the way we perceive sound. Listening is different. It expands on hearing when we pay attention to the meaning of what we hear. For example, a truck just rolled by on the road in front of our house. I, Jim, heard the noisy rumble, knew what it was, and after that paid no attention whatsoever. We do that when we're merely hearing the words someone else is speaking. They're just vibrations in the atmosphere. We nod, smile, perhaps even respond, but are we listening? Hardly. Listening requires that we open to the meaning of the other person's words, that we, in a very real way, enter into the experience those words are meant to convey. It's no longer just about sound, but about the thoughts, feelings, point of view, expectations, memories, sensations, beliefs, the whole of the other person, or at least as much of the whole as is available in the moment.
Thank you. I love that last paragraph. Because doesn't that evoke the whole nature of communication that we spoke about last week? It's about the thoughts, the feelings, the point of view, the expectations, memories, sensations, beliefs, the whole of the other person. A person is taking the time to share something with you. And what are we doing? Goofing off, right? What are we doing? Not all the time, but oftentimes. Yeah. Oftentimes we're not paying attention. You know, can we honestly say that 100% of the time, that 100% of the time we are doing 100% of the listening? Unfortunately, it doesn't always happen. Pass it back, please. It doesn't always happen like that. Oftentimes we are in the posture of listening, if you will. In other words, we're standing or we're sitting or we're in proximity to the other person, but are we really being attentive? Maybe not as much as we should be. So today's class, let me set up today's class. Today's class is going to explore Jewish wisdom on the topic. Jewish wisdom on the subject of listening. 5 distinct tools for listening better. As taught by various Jewish sources. We're going to have Torah sources, i.e. biblical sources. We'll have sources from the Talmud, sources from the Code of Jewish Law, all about how to listen and how to battle against the tendency that we have to not listen properly. In other words, there are challenges with listening. There are challenges to us listening. And we'll go through them. 5 different challenges to listening, to really listening, and 5 tools that Judaism, that Torah teaches us that we can use to listen a little bit better. One thing to keep in mind as we go through this class is that some of these ideas, some of these tools may be taught not traditions, really, but it might be taught in other principles. You might open up a self-help book on communication, on listening. You know, how to listen better to your kids, how to listen better to your spouse, how to listen better to your boss, how to listen better to your employees. Whatever it is, you might encounter some of these ideas in these books. And that's okay, because if something is true, it's going to be in many different places. What's really cool about this is that you're going to see these incredibly powerful tools found, rooted in ancient Jewish ideas. And once again, we'll see how Torah is way ahead of its time. Just to keep this, I want you to keep this visual in mind. I keep it in mind often. The Torah in the book of, I want to say Numbers, but it might be Exodus. Hey, but who's counting? So the Torah somewhere says that the Ark of the Covenant, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark? Mm-hmm. Nothing to do with that. So I don't know, but the Ark that housed the tablets, the core of Torah, the Ten Commandments, right? The Ark, the Torah says, would travel ahead of the Jewish people as they wandered through the wilderness those 40 years. So wherever they traveled, it was the Ark that went before them. And the question is, why did the Ark go before them? And the answer is, one of the answers is, because Torah, which the Ark contained, Torah is always ahead of its time. Torah is so ahead of its time. And this is going to be another example. The most modern, cutting edge, latest findings in how to listen. We got this. But it's not just about, hey, we got this. It's about learning it and implementing it into our lives to see real change, to be better listeners. Because better listeners allow the other to feel safe in sharing. Because someone's going to be vulnerable to share. They're only going to share if someone's receiving what they're sharing. It's not, no one's going to make themselves vulnerable to reveal, to share, to expose themselves if you're checking your Twitter feed. It's not a thing that's going to happen. So to have a real connection with somebody else where there's open sharing on both sides requires listening. So now let's jump in. Before we jump into the Jewish tips and tools for healthier listening, let's watch a short video that depicts a dysfunctional conversation, or dysfunctional is maybe a harsh term. It's a challenging conversation, a tense conversation that is kind of an everyday conversation, or an everyday conversation going sideways. Take a look at this video, and I want you to pay attention like we did last week. Please pay attention to what goes wrong in this conversation. Try to identify where things go bad. Oh, hold on. There we go. Wouldn't you know it? Okay, hold on. Got a new speaker system, and we're getting it going over here. Let's see.
Ah. Oxen.
Sounds like oxen, but it's ox-in. It's not a sacrificial thing. Okay, here we go.
Dysfunctional communication can result in different feelings. Take a look at this.
Wow, it's late.
What were you expecting? You know I need to work long hours to make ends meet. Would you rather I didn't work?
Honey, I'm not complaining. I'm just saying that...
I know. I heard you. I'm used to these talks of yours. There's always something wrong. Yesterday it was the color of the suit I bought. Today it's my work schedule. I can't do anything right.
No, Michael, don't get upset. It's not about you. It's about me.
I'm sorry, Judy. How can it be that you're complaining about me, but it's not about me? That doesn't make any sense.
Oh dear. I sure hope the skills you will pick up in this lesson will allow us to sort this all out.
Anybody else feel like tea and crumpets? I don't even know what crumpets are, but it feels very British. Now on the BBC, how do we help this couple? So what do you think? What went wrong here? Huh? A lot of things. Yeah, let's identify some of them.
The husband jumped to conclusion. And she was welcoming him. I mean, the first thing I was...
She said, oh, you're late. And what does he do?
But he just jumped to conclusions.
Jumps to conclusions. Yeah. Good. What else? What else goes wrong?
He's defensive.
Super defensive. Yeah. You said he looks tired? Yeah. Right. Or he heard it as a complaint, at least. Yeah. Okay, good.
She started with you.
Based on... Sorry?
She started with
She started with you. Yeah. That's in violation of what we said last week. Lesson 1, Clause 2.4, right? No you messages yet.
And he says, if he's answering before, he said, I'm used to your lectures,
yeah.
My suit, about yeah. Whatever. He's not listening to
not, yeah. He's very defensive. Yeah. Would you rather not meet, you mean not working yet? Rather than just make a statement, a you statement to start off. Okay, good. Very good. All right, folks, I think we've got it. It's great to see you this week. No,
I'm kidding. Oh, you know, I didn't understand what she said. It's not about you, it's about me.
Right, and he doesn't understand that either. So by the end of the class... Sorry?
I didn't understand what she meant. She didn't get a chance.
She didn't get a chance to explain it. He kept cutting her off. And,
yep. Right.
You know, I'm lonely. I wish I could spend evenings with you, or I'm worried when you come home. If she didn't talk to him as if it were about him.
Good. That's a great observation. That's a very good observation. We're going to come back to this all the way at the end. After we learn the 5 Jewish tips of healthy listening, we're going to come back to this. And we'll have a new script and a new outcome. And I think it may be a little bit clearer what she means. Clearly, the communication on both sides is not going well.
Last week, though, we learned about the importance of saying I.
Right. Yes. That's why you said, I don't understand what she meant by... Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. So we're going to get some clarity on this and learn some practical tools throughout this class. Let's jump right in. And I want to ask the following question as a lead-in. And that is, why is it that sometimes we don't listen properly? Why do you think we don't listen properly?
We're preoccupied.
Preoccupied. Good. What else?
We want to get our point across. And it's important to do that.
We have our own stuff to share. Good.
All about me.
All about... How can it be all about you if it's all about me? It's like the guy that goes on a date. First date. And for 2 hours, he's talking about himself. I did this, and I did that, and I do this, and I do that. After 2 hours, like, enough about me. So what do you think about me? Right. Yeah. Impatience, good. What else? Why might we... Right. I've got it figured out before you even start. Good. What else?
When they ask, if I may feel like they ask me to do something, or that I'm going to be used, or I may not feel like I have the resources that they may be asking me for, so I'll back off.
So I don't even want to listen to it if it's going to be challenging to me. I don't want to take that in. I'd rather just keep that away. Right. Right. Okay, good. Good. I hope you don't feel that here, even though this class is a little bit over an hour. Okay. So let's address some of the challenges of listening. I want to begin with one that I don't know that was mentioned directly in the last few minutes, but I think sometimes it touches on this idea. And that is that sometimes we don't feel like the other person has anything of value, to share with us. Right? Sometimes we might feel like the other person simply does not have what to share. We don't value the other person. We don't value their perspective. We don't value their opinion. We don't value, you know, if communication is about sharing and revealing themselves, well, I'd rather you not reveal yourself because I don't think that you have anything to share of value. So this is a very basic obstruction to listening. Because when a person that we kind of perceive or measure up in this way comes in front of us, we might automatically tune them out before they even begin talking. It's like I'm already delegitimizing this person, not in a malicious way, not in an angry way, but just in, I'm not really going to pay attention. Because I'm probably not going to get much from this person or out of this person. So this is a very basic impediment to listening. And I want to share with you that Jewish wisdom addresses this challenge and gives us a completely different perspective. Barbara, please read this one. Page 47, text 3a.
Ben Zoma would say, who is wise? One who learns from every person.
This is an amazing teaching. It comes from Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers. And it says, Eizehu chacham halomed mikol adam, who is wise? The person who learns from everyone. It's an amazing idea. And it's one that you might at first glance say, well, there's no way it means that literally. One who learns from every person? What, you can learn from every person? You can't learn from every person. Some people have nothing to share. Some people don't have wisdom. Or maybe what it means is learning from every person is learning what not to do. Right? From that person, I'm going to learn what not to do. No, that's not what it means. Ben Zoma is saying, Eizehu chacham halomed mikol adam. You have to learn from, if you want to be wise, you got to learn from every single person because every person has elements of wisdom. Let's continue with the Abar Benel's interpretation, text 3b. Or please continue.
Wisdom is shared among the general population. The prophet said, let not the wise man boast of his wisdom, for no one can claim to have gained true wisdom alone without the contribution of others. Ben Zoma therefore said, who is wise? One who learns from every person. Inasmuch as wisdom is shared by the collective of humanity, one can only gain complete wisdom through learning from every person.
To me, this is an unbelievable text. What the Abar Benel is saying, one of the commentaries on Pirkei Avot, on the Mishnah, what the Abar Benel is saying is that wisdom is not in the hands of the few. Wisdom is in the hands of every single human being. In other words, it's not like the elite or the few or whoever it is has a monopoly on wisdom. Wisdom exists in every single person. Even someone that you might say, oh, that person, oh, they don't have anything to share with me. They don't have anything to give me. They don't have any wisdom for me. Wisdom is found in every single person. We ought not discount anyone before hearing what they have to say, before listening to what they're telling us, because we will be shortchanging ourselves and missing out on the wisdom that they have. This is a very important teaching. It's very important on multiple levels, but it really changes the way we look and the way we value other people. In other words, what the Mishnah is telling us is that unlike popular convention or popular way of thinking, which is that the wise are those who have the most knowledge, in Judaism teaches us that to be wise is to be open to learning from everyone. It's not about how much you have, but it's about how much you're open, how open you are to learning and to being curious to learn from others. So the greatest measure of wisdom is not what you're currently in possession of, but it's in your perspective on learning and being open to receiving from others. It's an incredible way of seeing things. Make sense? Let's take a look at text number 4. Text number 4 is another commentary on Pirkei Avot on the Mishnah. And in text 4, we gain insight into the meaning of the Jewish phrase for a scholar, which is Talmud Chacham. And here, Talmud Chacham is typically translated as a scholar or a Torah scholar, a Jewish scholar. But Talmud Chacham, as we'll see, has a more significant literal meaning that has a lot to share with us. Melinda, please read text 4.
How appropriate is that the term of our sages used to refer to a wise scholar is a Talmud Chacham, which literally translates as a student of the wise. It is not possible to detach the word wise, chacham, from the word student, talmud, because only one who views him or herself to be a student can be deemed wise. While it is possible to be a student without being wise, such as a student who has just begun studying and has yet to accumulate wisdom, it is impossible to be wise without being a student.
You can't be wise. Judaism teaches you cannot be wise without being a student, without being a student of others, without being a student of the world. Think about how much wisdom exists amongst people. Sometimes we are straight up biased, and we think that no, only we and those like us have wisdom and other people don't have wisdom. I think even historically we're biased, that our generation is smart. We've come up with so many things, but back in the day, what did they know? What did they know? There are still things that we can't figure out that they did. How did they build the pyramids? Right? How did they pull off some of these things, some of these marvels of ancient civilizations? We don't know today how they did it without the machinery that we have. We can't figure this stuff out. Right? So we think sometimes we're biased to think, we're prejudiced to think that only we contain wisdom and others don't. And Judaism says that's not true and that's folly. That is silly to think that you're the only one that has wisdom, or that, again, those that you think have wisdom. Everyone has what to share. And therefore, it behooves us to listen to those that are speaking to us. You just might learn something from them. Right? If you're in the conversation anyway, might as well pay attention and listen, because again, this person probably does possess wisdom that we can learn from. Make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
So
good.
The listener has a closed mind.
Challenge number one is that the listener has a closed mind to this person. The antidote, the listening tip, is to meditate, to contemplate, to think about the fact that this person has something to share. And if you want to get a little bit more mystical, like in text 5, which we're going to skip, if you want to get more mystical, Kabbalah teaches us that everything that a person encounters, everything that we see or hear, is a message directed to us that is necessary for us to pay attention to at that moment. It's something, it's a message that we need to be present for. So if that's the case, and someone's speaking to me, I can say, look, number one, they have what to share. Number two, it's by divine design that this conversation is happening. What are the messages that I can glean from it? Now, we have to balance that. Adina Malka, you mentioned before, what if you're locked into a conversation with an hour and you got to go? So you're allowed to, we have permission to cut conversation short. But the point really is, as you're there, when you're present, and the person is speaking, if you haven't cut it short yet, might as well listen. If you gotta go, you gotta go. But if you're listening, might as well listen. Like, I always think about kids in school. If you're spending the time sitting in class, might as well pay attention. You might as well learn something while you're there, right? What's the use of wasting your time? Right? It's just, might as well maximize the opportunity that you have. And the message here is, there's an opportunity. There's another human being that has wisdom, who's sharing with you. Now, if it's unhealthy, if it's dangerous, if it's gossipy, if it's, you know, if you gotta go, then again, you're allowed to cut things short. But if it's none of the above, if it's just that you are prejudiced, you're biased, you're like, yeah, well, they're not gonna tell me anything fabulous, then maybe that's a sign for us to work against it, to push against that impediment that we have and actually pay attention. So let's look. Let's summarize this first tip again. We have 5 today. This is number 1. Let's go to page 51 in the box, figure 2.1. You guys see that? Page 51, the shaded box. Yes? I'm hearing lots of yeses in my mind. Okay, figure 2.1, listening impediment number 1 is a lack of respect for the person with whom I am conversing. The antidote to that, i.e. the listening tool that we're learning from Jewish sources, is contemplate that number 1, every person has wisdom or a perspective that I lack, and 2, everything that I hear is a vital message that is intended for me. With these two ideas in mind, we can be better listeners in the moment. Now, let's move on to tool number one. Tool number two. Before we do that, any questions or comments about the first idea that we mentioned? Everyone's in agreement? Yes? I'm listening.
There's even if you're uncomfortable with some, say you're in a conversation, and that tension that you feel about something, can it actually be an opportunity for you to learn something about yourself?
100%.
What makes you impatient or whatever, and that's the opportunity for growth.
Opportunity for growth. We're actually going to talk a little bit more about that in tip number three. That's about the content. This is more about the person. That we might just straight up dismiss a person based on the fact that we don't perceive that they will share anything of value with us. And the antidote to that is value the person. Respect others. Respect the fact that they have wisdom. And be open to hearing what they're saying. So it's about the person. I think your focus was on the message. And that will have a separate tip for tip number three, which is amazing. Yeah. Exactly.
Sometimes a child needs you to listen at that, just because of that, you know.
Right.
This teaches us not to be dismissive, because we can even learn something from them, or everything that we hear is vital to, like, we're meant to hear that.
Right. So. I think you mentioned two great points. Number one, we can learn something from our kids. Number two, this is really, I think, the overarching point, but I think you hit the nail on the head, whatever the cliche is. If we don't listen to our kids, they're not going to be sharers. And if they're not sharers, if we don't allow them to share with us, they're not going to be trained to be sharers. And they're going to be closed people. In general. I mean, hopefully not, but it may train them to being more closed as opposed to being expressive and open. The more we allow for that expression, the healthier it is for our children. Yeah.
Sometimes they don't get the timing right. Like, they want to tell you something right now when you're in the middle of something and you can't just, like, sometimes I try to say, like, I really want to hear what you have to say, but, like,
right.
In a minute.
Right. Very soon.
Yeah, the timing is the hard.
Look, time is. I don't know that we're going to solve the time paradigm challenge. That you'll have to wait for the spring course, where we have a course on Kabbalah, and the question is going to be: is time real or imagined? How real is time? And can we do some time travel? Like, how? So that's coming up in the spring, but it's a challenge, right? Especially because you're right. Kids will always typically. It seems like they always. Come with things when, you know, you're out the door or whatever it is. Nonetheless, it's important to create that space.
It's a challenge to listen, but it's also a challenge to share, because you're so vulnerable. You may tell them some information that they use against you later.
That's I don't know that we're going to address that part of it today. That's a valid concern. You know, you have to be careful. But in general, the point here is that if we're a little bit dismissive of somebody because we don't think that they have what to share, again, Judaism says otherwise. Let's move on to tip number two, tool number two, in our toolbox of five today. So tool number two addresses the challenge, and this is different than what we just said. So hear me out for a second. It's addressing the challenge of you thinking that you know what the other person is saying because you know them. In other words, because of your prior knowledge of them or history with them or whatever it is, so you're not even really paying attention to what they're saying because you've already got them figured out, or you jump to conclusions and assume that they're saying one thing because they've said something like that in the past, but that's not what they're actually saying. To give you a concrete example, maybe yesterday, the wife was complaining about the suit that he bought and criticizing. But maybe today she's not criticizing about coming home late. Maybe she's making a different point. But if in our minds, we've already put someone in a box and we know what they say, what they mean, what they're saying, then we're not even listening because we're already attributing it to something in the past. There's an amazingly powerful biblical precedent for this. It takes place in a dialogue between Moses, the great Jewish leader, and two of the 12 tribes, the tribes of Reuben and Gad. What was going on? Let me give you the background. So this is toward the end of the Jewish people's 40 years of wandering in the desert. They wandered for 40 years. And now they were ready to enter the land, the promised land, the land of Israel. So the Exodus happened 40 years prior. In the last 40 years, they were wandering around. And now they are poised, they are ready to enter the land of Israel. They are now on the eastern side of the Jordan River. Eastern banks of the Jordan River outside of Israel. When two tribes approach Moses and they tell Moses about Israel, we would prefer to settle right here. We don't want to go in. This is a great area. This is great land. It's wonderful. We can develop it. Let's stay right here. Let's read this inside and also read Moses' reaction. Text 6a. Vicky, please read.
The tribes of Reuben and Gad had a great abundance of livestock, and they saw that the lands of Jazer and Gilead were ideally suited for livestock. They approached Moses, Eleazar the priest, and the leaders of the community. If we have found favor in your eyes, they said, let this land be given to your servants for a possession. Do not take us across the Jordan River. Moses said to the tribes of Gad and Reuben, shall your brothers go to war while you sit here? Why do you discourage the Israelites from crossing over to the land that God has given them? This is what your fathers did when I sent them from Kadesh Barnea to explore the land. They went up to Eshcol Valley and saw the land, and they returned with a negative report and discouraged the Israelites from crossing into the land that God has given them.
So again, the two tribes request to settle here on the eastern side of the Jordan out of Israel. And what is Moses' reaction? What does Moshe say?
Criticizes.
Just like your fathers 40 years prior. Why are we wandering for 40 years? Why did we wander? Because when I sent in spies 40 years ago, they came back and said, now we don't like it, let's stay here. That's why we got stuck here. Now you're doing the same thing as your fathers. That whole generation was decreed by God to perish in the wilderness. That's why it took 40 years. They all died of natural causes, and when they died out, their children were meant and designated and what whatever it is to enter the land of Israel. They were supposed to be the ones. And now we have two tribes saying, now we don't want to go in. We'd rather not. We like this place. Who needs Israel? You're going to turn everyone against Israel again, and we're going to be stuck again. And Moses, this was personal also. His people were dying, perished. His people were never going to go into the land. His generation, the ones that he took out of Egypt, not the kids, his generation, they were the ones that were forbidden to enter the land. And he was also forbidden to enter the land. And some say that his being prevented from entering the land originated with the sin of the spies. Because following the sin of the spies, God says no one from this generation is going into the land of Israel except for Joshua and Caleb. Not except for Moses. We all know that Moses hit the rock, the Torah says that he hit the rock instead of speaking to the rock to produce water, and that's when God said, you're not going to enter the land. But some commentaries say it was decreed by the sin of the spies. You can imagine, Moses hears two tribes saying, you know what? We like this land. We don't need to go into the land. He criticizes them very sharply. Take a look at what happens next. Vicky, please continue 6b.
The tribes of Gad and Reuben approached Moses and said, we will build here on the east bank of the Jordan River, pens for our livestock and cities for our children. But we will arm ourselves for battle and lead our fellow Israelites into battle until we have brought them to their place. Meanwhile, our children will reside in these fortified cities for protection. from the inhabitants of the land. We shall not return to our homes here until each of the Israelites has taken possession of his inheritance.
So what is the response of the two tribes to Moses' criticism? What do they say?
We'll go to war.
Unlike the spies 40 years prior that said, Israel is way too dangerous. We will not be able to conquer it. It is too dangerous. This is not going to work out. And that disheartened, that made a weakening of the spirit of the Jewish people collectively, which is why, again, God said, forget about it. You're not going to go in. Unlike them, 40 years prior, these tribes were saying, we're not going to abandon you. We're not saying we're afraid. We will go fight. In fact, they said, we'll go front lines. We'll fight together with our brothers. We'll even go front lines. But then afterwards, we'd like to request to settle back here. We'll leave the women and children here. We'll go out to battle. And then we'll come back because it's wonderful. A little bit of a different message, right? Now, some commentaries say that they changed their tune once they got pushback from Moses. But some commentaries say that that's what they meant from the beginning. You with me on this? Some commentaries say that they meant originally to abandon ship. And Moses criticized them, so they said, you know what, we won't abandon ship, we'll go to battle, and then we'll come back to our families. But some say, including the Abar Benel again in text 6c, the Abar Benel says, no, they originally intended to fight with their brothers. They only asked that eventually they should settle this land and have a portion here. But what happened? Moses jumped to a conclusion. Because he heard them say, we want to settle here, the first thing he hears is, history is repeating itself. Even the children are like the parents. They're also afraid. They also don't want to go in. And this is going to cause chaos. This is what he was responding to. Text 6C. You mind reading? Text 6C, page 54. This is the Abar Benel's incredible interpretation.
The tribes of Gad and Reuben were terror-stricken at Moses' response. They wished to tell him that, with all due respect to his greatness, he had not understood their intention. When they said, do not take us across the Jordan River, they had not intended that they would not join their brothers there in battle. Their sole intent was with regard to their eventual inheritance. They did not wish to permanently settle across the Jordan River.
How often does this happen with us? You know, our child says something, maybe a child complains about a teacher. And so we think, okay, it's because they're not that interested in school. Are we really paying attention, or do we attribute it to maybe things that happened in the past? Right, we kind of fit it into assumptions that we've made, or that even if it's based on valid information in the past, but we take that information in the past about that person or about other people like that person, and we apply it to the present conversation to the point that we don't listen. The second impediment to true listening, to healthy listening, is assuming that we know what the other person is saying. It is, but within measure. In other words, you're right. In an ideal world, the communicator, the one speaking, would articulate exactly what they mean and exactly what they're feeling and exactly the intentions behind it and how it's different than what you might think I mean. I don't mean to say what my parents said 40 years ago, that they were afraid. I'm not afraid. We will fight. But you're right. Ideally, if we scripted it perfectly, it would be up front. All the information would be up front so that it wouldn't be open to any type of misunderstanding. But we don't live in an ideal world. And people oftentimes know how they feel and know how they think, and they're just expressing how they feel without all of the context behind it. And at what Yiddish, it would be bavarning, without all of the forewarning and all of the disclaimers or whatever, without the fine print. They'll just share with you. And our job is to hear, is to listen without any previous prejudice or bias, without attributing it to anything else that we might know. Now, again, we have to be careful, because if somebody has a negative history of, you know, harming us or whatever it is, God forbid, right? So you have to be cautious, and sometimes it would be very naive not to keep things in mind about the person who's speaking and not take that into consideration. It doesn't mean every conversation has to be from a perfectly clean slate. But what it does mean is that we should be a little bit more open to seeking out what this person is saying in the now, as opposed to just defaulting to what they or others like them have said previously. Does this make sense? Is it resonating? Okay. Page 56. I hope I'm communicating clearly. Page 56, figure 2.2. Let's summarize this tool. So again, number two, the challenge, the impediment to listening is fitting what I hear into the mental image that I have created of my fellow conversationalist based on previous experiences. That's the challenge. And the tool, the solution is clear my mind of any pre-existing opinions regarding my fellow. So I am clearing the mind and I'm being open to genuinely hearing and trying to understand what this person is saying. In other words, what could have been done in this Reuben-God-Moses dialogue is Moses could have asked a question. Right? How could this conversation have gone differently? Instead of Moses saying, "How could you do it again? Don't you know this is what happened? This is why we got into this spot. This is why I got into this spot. I can't see Israel because of this."
He's using "you" instead of saying, "Yeah."
Yeah, well, let's see. Yeah, why do you discourage the Israelites? Yeah. This is what your fathers did. I mean, this is... Shall your brothers go to war while you sit here? Why do you discourage the Israelites from crossing over to the land? This is what your fathers did.
He didn't have to say any of it.
Isn't it?
All he had to do was ask them why.
He could have just, right, he could have said, I don't want to give away some of the other listening tools that we have because we still have three left. But he could have said, "Let me understand what you're saying." Or, "Why are you asking? What is your intention? Are you asking to totally skip the war?" In other words, he could have clarified. This is not, by the way, this is not like, hey, Moses critique class. We're not about, you know, picking apart. But it is an instructive message. Because what we find here is a request that's being made, a harsh response, and then, according to Abarbanel at least, and others, a clarification of the original intent. And again, you could say that maybe they should have clarified it up front. But really, we can also take a message from this that maybe as we listen, we should be open to actually listening to what they're saying and not immediately jumping to conclusions as far as what it means and where it's coming from, and then attacking the other person, like in the video, right? You attack it, you're attacking me today like you did yesterday with the suit. Yesterday's yesterday. There you go. That's an I phrase. I like it. It's perfect. Maybe we can get this thing amended. It's like the guy that's in synagogue listening to the Joseph story. I feel like I said this recently. And the brothers are selling Joseph as a slave, and he's crying. They say, "Why are you crying? It's such a tragedy. How could this happen?" He said, "Don't you hear this every year?" "Yeah, but I thought they would behave differently this year." Anyway.
Based on something you said a little earlier, the explosion from Moses seems to me appropriate because it gave information about what he was thinking.
Where he was at.
And without exploding, there wouldn't be any space for him to take in a new thought.
I hear what you're saying. The question is that the only way? Or can he ask? You know, can he say, either make a statement, "I need reassurance that you're going to be there with us or with the other tribes before I give this promise," or, "Please clarify your intent. What are you actually asking? Let me understand better of what this request is, because, you know, it that's going to affect the way I respond to my decision." I think there are ways to do without the the emotional response. And what it kind of portrays is simply hearing something based on previous experiences and previous situations that are similar. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask, in Shul, when we did this Parsha,
yeah.
I think I remember you making a comment about it. I don't know if I'm remembering it wrong, but did you say something like that it was out of piety for Moshe that they didn't want to leave
yeah.
him in his grave?
I did say that, yeah.
Like, and so, it's especially like if you think of it in terms of your children, you're assuming the worst, right? And then, in fact, you're like, no, Mommy, I just wanted to... And then they break your heart because they wanted to be really sweet or something. And
right.
You assumed it was worse because yesterday it wasn't what it was.
Yeah.
And so, if that's behind
yeah.
this too, I was expecting that to be here because you thought.
It's not. Well, it comes from. I think, if I recall, it comes from the son of Rabbi Chaim Vital, whose name was Rabbi Shmuel Vital, a Kabbalist. It's not a very well-known commentary. It's not very well-known. And what Nancy is sharing is something that I've shared in the past in, when we read this Torah portion in synagogue, is that what was the intent of the tribes? It wasn't because the cattle liked that and they had good... It wasn't great parks and recreation and good grazing. It was because Moses was going to be buried there and they didn't want to leave him behind. They loved Moses so much, they didn't want to abandon him. But they didn't want to tell him that. So they came up with this excuse of the cattle and the kids and whatever, all this stuff. But what this does is it makes it even more, as you said, heartbreaking. Here you have this coming from a place of love, but maybe not 100% sharing the intention for whatever reason. And not only is it not being kind of perceived and understood on that loving level, but Moses is looking at it as like almost like a personal attack against him and his mission of getting everyone into Israel. So it's thank you for sharing this. It does make the contrast even starker.
Moses was a man of vision. We know that. Perhaps the most vision of any person we read about the Torah. It's a fact that Gad and Reuben, probably Gad and Reuben, didn't first say, we're going to fight with you, but we want to stay here.
Right. They didn't clarify.
They didn't say that. Now maybe it's because that was the cover story. But the point is, which we're saying, but
yeah.
My point is, Moses gave them a guilt trip. And he didn't let them go down that road too far. He nipped that in the bud, and he made them reassure him, and maybe that wasn't their intent in the first place.
Some commentators say exactly what you're saying. Some commentators say that they meant to abandon ship. But because he came back so strong, so they said, okay, fine, let's compromise. We'll go to battle, but some say no, that was their original intention.
So I guess my point is that to get back to where we were, in conversation, when we see people going down a path, before they get too entrenched in that path, does it behoove us sometimes to kind of get them to correct them in the direction?
Yeah, the question is how to do that. Is it by asking questions or by making assumptive statements? Are we making an assumption and making a statement and making a judgment on what they're saying based on what we think they're saying? Or do we actually ask and give them permission to further explain and clarify? Those are the two different paths. Yeah.
I don't have a point. I have a question.
Sure.
Is there a time when you can say, okay, enough already, I'm going to do this? I'm thinking of the Torah study process. A person came to the Torah study and had always knew exactly what they were going to say before they got there. It didn't
right.
matter what was talked about.
Right.
And, you know, I got to the point where I just... And the rabbi always called on this person.
Right.
So after 3 years, I just said, and I got up and walked out and
then right.
went back. I mean, isn't there a point that that's okay?
Yeah, so here's the thing. There's always a balance of getting the information, like in a class, getting the information across and creating a dialogue. You know, there's always a challenge with that, and it's a challenge that we share here as well. I think your question is there ever a point in time where you can cut, and as I said before, cutting a conversation short? And I think the answer is yes. I think the answer is yes. But it should be done in a respectful way, and it should be done in a way that allows the person to feel that they're still honored and valued, and they can still share. But there are other constraints that necessitate a conversation perhaps outside of this specific context. But I think if the question is there ever a point in time where you can say we have to kind of conclude this conversation for right now, now the answer is yes. Jordan.
Oh, present day Jordan.
Yeah, it's outside of Israel, outside the borders. They were the first ones to expand the borders.
But they did expand the borders.
They were living, it was like Jewish territory, but outside the borders. Yeah. Yeah.
How I think fundamentally they have different goals, and all the efforts over a long period of time by American presidents and all sorts of people have totally failed to resolve differences, even though they may be listening to one another. Neither of them are convinced the other one is.
Yeah. I think when we talk about Israel and some of the conflict in the Middle East, that's another class. That's a whole discussion for itself as far as why that breaks down. But yeah, listen, maybe we can apply some of these ideas. Maybe there are other factors at play. But I think I think it's healthier for us to think about this in personal terms as opposed to thinking about this as someone else's, you know, how someone else is or isn't listening. It's about how I'm listening versus how I'm not listening. Yeah. Yeah.
That the Talmud and the Torah give us, that the missing piece, the active listening piece that we're learning here, is also, seems like it's about our ability. And what I love about Jews is asking good questions.
Yeah.
Just stopping and asking good questions. And we use esteem Moses in this sense, so yeah. he forgot in his active listening right. because he got triggered emotionally.
Or maybe it's meant to be a lesson for us. Maybe it had to happen so that we could learn it right now, today, in 2018.
It's all about assumptions. It yeah. feels like, you know, we go to fragile assumption through everything yeah. that's been talked about.
Yeah, yeah. Very good. Thank you. Now let's jump to listening tool number three. We're at listening tool number three. And this is my favorite. At least it's in my top five. Okay, the Semmelweis effect. You guys know the Semmelweis effect? Semmelweis. Dr. Semmelweis from Vienna. The 1800s, the mid-1800s. He was the head of the OB ward in Vienna General Hospital. Have you guys ever watched that show, Vienna General? It's really popular in Europe, apparently. Anyway, huh? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's crazy. Anyway, Vienna, 1850s. What happens is Dr. Semmelweis, his name was Dr. Ignaz Semmelweis, but we called him Iggy. So he was, again, the head of the OB division, and he noticed a very troubling trend. You see, they had two clinics in the hospital. Two clinics where women would give birth. One was the doctor's clinic, staffed by doctors and medical professionals with their licenses, whatever they had then, back in the day. The other clinic was staffed by medical students. It was the learning part of the hospital, and that's where the students were practicing. Although even doctors practice medicine. You ever notice that?
Yeah.
We don't have it down pat. We're just practicing. Anyway, so there was the doctor's clinic and the student's clinic. And here was the, and you would think, perhaps, that mothers getting ready to give birth would prefer the doctor's clinic. These are approved and trained and, you know, certified medical professionals, and yet the opposite was true. You see, the mortality rate for the new mothers in the student's clinic was at about 3%, which was the norm for the general society at that point in time, about 3% mortality rate for the new mothers. But in the doctor's clinic, it was astronomically higher. Women mothers were dying shortly after childbirth at an alarming rate. And here, Dr. Ignaz Semmelweis, a Jewish doctor, took it upon himself to figure out what was going on in his hospital. This was meshuggah. This was not okay. This was a tragedy. This was horrific. What was going on? 1 second. So what he did was he looked at what is happening in this clinic versus that clinic. What are they doing with in the student's clinic that they're not doing with the doctors in the doctor's clinic? What are they doing? So the women in the doctor's, in the student's clinic, they were giving birth on their side. In the doctor's clinic, they were giving birth on their back. So he said, okay, let's change it. In the doctor's clinic, let's also turn the women on their sides as they give birth, and maybe that will reduce nothing. It didn't have an effect. The mothers were still dying. They said, okay, in the hospital, in the main hospital with the doctors, there's a priest or priests that walk by with bells. Whenever somebody dies, they walk by they ring a bell in the hallway. So maybe that is frightening the new mothers, and that's causing them to die. So maybe no more priests with the bells. So they weren't doing that in the student's clinic, so they took away the priests with the bells. Didn't change anything. Until something happened. Semmelweis noticed one of his colleagues, a fellow doctor, was doing an autopsy in the doctor's clinic. And as he did an autopsy, he cut his finger. And shortly after the doctor cut his finger while doing the autopsy, he died. In the same way that the mothers were dying. And Semmelweis realized that maybe, just maybe, the difference between the doctor's clinic and the student's clinic is that in the student's clinic, they were just delivering babies. In the doctor's clinic, they were also doing autopsies on dead people, which is when you do autopsies. And maybe, just maybe, little pieces of corpse, little bits of death are being transferred like it did killing the doctor who got the cut. Maybe the doctors doing the autopsies are transferring little bits of corpse, pieces of death, to the new mothers, to the mothers as they deliver their children. And maybe that's how they're dying. It was a crazy thing. No one had ever conceived of such a notion. Louis Pasteur had not yet discovered what he discovered until just a few years later. This was incredibly bold of an assumption, but it's the only thing that made sense to him. So Semmelweis created a solution. No, a liquid solution. Like literally a solution. Chlorinated lime. Chlorinated lime solution. And he told the doctors, after the autopsies, before you administer medical care to the mothers and deliver their babies, wash your hands in this solution so that you don't transfer death to them. And they did it. And you know what happens? You know what happened? The mortality rate plummeted, dropped to the same levels. You would think that he would be lauded as a hero, that he'd be heralded in the newspapers by all the doctors. He would be the doctor of the century. But what actually happened is that he was harassed and mocked and fired and berated. And then he was locked up in an insane asylum, where he died 2 weeks later of the same thing that he discovered the mothers died of, a blood infection.
Oh, he never washed his.
I'm sure he was getting some medical care by a doctor who did not use his solution. So what happened was Semmelweis had a tragic ending to his life. And it would only be a few years later that the world would discover, through the science of Louis Pasteur, would discover the terms bacteria and germs, and actually put a label on what he had truly discovered a few years prior. But no one listened to him, even when they had the evidence. Why? This is what we call the Semmelweis effect. And now you'll know what the Semmelweis effect is. The Semmelweis effect is that people will not always listen to new ideas. If they challenge everything that you know, if they make you uncomfortable, and if they require a lot of effort. And that was the case here. Number one, his ideas, his notion of now you have to wash your hands between patients, that was unheard of. That you can transfer death transfers through a doctor's hands to another patient, that makes no sense. The ideas that he was postulating, the ideas that he was professing, that he was suggesting, challenged the very basic tenets of medicine that they knew. Number one, it was challenging. Number two, it was incriminating. Do you know what the insinuation was? Who was killing the mothers? The doctors were killing their own patients. That's uncomfortable to hear. So we talk about hearing uncomfortable conversations, right? You mentioned before, Ronnie, you mentioned before having an uncomfortable conversation, hearing something that challenges you and, you know, as a critique of you. And all we want to do is push that away and not listen. Semmelweis effect is not listening to incriminating information. And number three, it's demanding. It demands of us to change protocol, to change everything that we do and how we do things. And who wants to change? So the information is new, the information is incriminating, and the information is demanding. The Semmelweis effect says, in that case, human beings tend to not listen. I'd rather not listen than be challenged, be critiqued, and be demanded from. Does this make sense? So we have to be careful of this in our own lives. When we are having a conversation with somebody, and it's a conversation that is a little bit more demanding, or that challenges the way we see things, or that demands something from us, and all we want to do is not listen, because it's so much easier. It's so much easier not to listen, and not to pay attention, to dismiss it, to not be open to it. The message here is, we need to be open to it. Where we find this in Judaism, there's an incredible story of the Talmud about Rabbi Zeira. If you recall Rabbi Zeira from last week, he was the guy who received the golem from his colleague Rava. And he said, hey, return to the dust, return to the earth where you came from. So the same Rabbi Zeira lived in Babylonia and studied there. And at a certain point in his life, he moved to the land of Israel. The Talmud tells us what he did next. Marnie, please read this, page 57, text number 7. Again, page 57, text number 7. An unbelievable insight.
When Rabbi Zeira went to the land of Israel, he fasted 100 days and prayed that he would forget the Babylonian Talmud so that it would not be his ability to study Talmud.
They studied Talmud in Babylonia. They studied Talmud in Israel. There are two different Talmuds today that were written by the various academies. There's the Babylonian Talmud and what's called the Jerusalem Talmud. Rabbi Zeira fasted for 100 days to forget what he learned. The commentaries discuss, what does it mean? Forget everything, forget some of it. What does it mean to forget? But what does it mean for you and I? What is the implication here? Why did he want to forget his previous learning? He didn't, right, he didn't want there to be any blocks, any internal blocks to really, truly listening to new information. You see, the more you know, the less you may want to know, or the less you may be open to learning new things. The Semmelweis effect tells us, like I mentioned before, that the more you know, if you're a big doctor, you may not be open to this guy who says, oh, you're killing your patients by not washing your hands in this formula that I just concocted. You're like, okay, whatever. All the evidence. I don't care about the evidence. I'm stuck in my ways. I know what I know. Rabbi Zeira teaches us to purge ourselves. It doesn't mean literally that he didn't know the very alphabet. He didn't know the length. Of course he retained knowledge and information. But it didn't serve to obstruct him from taking in new information. Does this make sense? In other words, Rabbi Zeira, 1500, 1600, 1700 years ago, knew what we know today. And that is the dangers of thinking that you know I don't know, everything, but that you know it and that you're close to learning more about it. That's the challenge. The solution is clear the mind. Not only clear the mind, as we said before, of prejudices toward somebody and kind of assuming what they mean, but clearing your mind of what you already know so that you can be open to hearing something that you don't know. There's another text, we're not going to read this inside, text number 8, that talks about the beauty of writing, putting ink on a blank piece of paper, as opposed to writing on a previously written and erased paper. Remember back in the day when we used to write with pencil? It was great, right? You could erase it, but it always left a little bit of a residue, right? It wasn't perfect. So then you rewrote your answer, and then maybe you had to erase it again. If you do that 3, 4, 5 times, so let's say you're doing a math problem, and you need it back in the days in school, and you're trying to figure it out, eventually it becomes a little bit messy. Whereas if it's written on a clean sheet of paper, the paper accepts it in a clean fashion. We are encouraged to be a blank sheet of paper. It doesn't mean we have to be totally ignorant and totally, you know, unlearned and unlettered and all that stuff. It doesn't mean that. It means to be open. It's if I were to put it into other language, I would say a suspension of self. It doesn't mean we don't exist. It doesn't mean I don't exist. But it means in this moment, I am suspending myself. Not like school suspension, like you're out of school. But like taking self, putting it on the side to really be clear, open, and focused on what information and what this person is telling me now. I am totally open to hearing your perspective, to hearing your ideas. And I'm not going to let my own ideas about the topic get in the way. I am putting up a blank sheet of paper to write on. You know the emptiest cup? The emptiest cup is the cup that's full because it can't take anything else in it. Paradoxically, an empty cup is the fullest cup because it's prepared, it's ready to receive. To empty our cup doesn't mean this. You know what cup also means in Yiddish? Cup means the head. To empty our cup means clear the mind and be present. Cup means head in Yiddish. It means empty the mind and be present to listen, to focus, to absorb the information, the conversation that is coming at me. Does this make sense? Yes? Now let's summarize this by looking at page 61, figure 2.3, number 3. This is for the number 3. Listening impediment is superimposing the other's perspective on my own. I don't know if that's the impediment. The impediment is not hearing the other person because I have my own entrenched perspective. And the listening tool is clear my mind of any pre-existing perspective, empty my mind, and focus only on the content of the conversation, and then do all the reconciliation later, figure out does it make sense or not, but at least listen in that moment with a clear and open mind. All right, let's move on to number 4. We have 2 more tips, and we have just a few minutes left. So the second to last tip is about listening to the person and not just listening to what they're saying. This is really important. See, sometimes you might hear and listen to the words that the person is saying, but you might miss the intent and where it's coming from. For example, a couple is driving along the road. They're on a road trip or they're just driving around town. And the wife says to the husband, "Honey, would you like to stop for a drink?" Imagine if the husband says no and keeps on driving. Is the husband really listening or he's missing the point? I'm giving you a very easy, right, multiple choice. What's really the point? She wants to stop. Now, why doesn't she just say, "I would like to stop for a drink, can we?" Okay, whatever. She didn't. But when she says, "Would you like to stop for a drink?" a good listener will not only hear the words as the question, but understand the intent, and then say, "Would you like to stop for a drink? I would love to stop with you. I would love to, you know, to have a beverage with you." And that's a way of really listening. I'll give you another example. When I was a kid, so there's always that family that you would call and say, "Hey, can I speak with, hi," you know, back in the day when everyone had the tethered phone. So, "Hi, is Maishi there?" And they would answer, "Yes," and hang up the phone. I mean, that's what you asked, right? "Is Maishi here?" "Yes." And I think we're done. If they were really listening, what was I asking? But I didn't ask that. I just said, "Is Maishi here?" But a good listener says, why are you asking that? To just find out, just keep tracks, keep tabs on my issue. Come on. It's because you want to speak to him. So good listening, tip number four is, don't just listen to the words. Don't just listen to the phraseology. Listen to the what we're calling meta messages. Listen to the message behind the message, where the message is coming from. An example of this, the Jewish source of this, if you will, is the four children at the Seder on Passover. Right? We have four children. The wise, the wicked, the simple, and the one who doesn't know how to ask. These come from various verses in Torah, text 10a, 10b, and 10c are these verses. Well, three out of the four ask. The fourth doesn't ask, so we're meant to prompt them and tell them about the story of the Exodus and Passover and the whole celebration. But the first three ask. And the source of this are verses in Torah, in the Bible. Where it says, one day your child may ask, what happened with the Exodus? Why are we doing these observances? Etc. And this is the answer that you should give. And you might think that all three instances, text 10a, 10b, 10c, it's all basically the same thing. It's kids asking, what's going on? Why are you doing this? What are we doing? Etc. But we know in the Haggadah, the Passover liturgy that we say at the Seder, we know that if you look closely at the questions, these are different children. One is the wise child. One is the rebellious child. One is the child that's very simple. And you have to answer each one differently. Even if the questions sound similar, you have to know where the questions are coming from. You have to discern from what. Don't listen to the question. Listen to the questioner. Don't listen to the statement. Listen to the stater. Listen to who the person is. Get the messages of what the person is really saying. So to summarize this one, and then we're going to wrap it up with tip number five. Take a look at page 65. Tip number four, tool number four is the impediment is listening to the question instead of the questioner. And the tool is look for cues that inform me of the meta messages. And finally, the last tip, and this is a really important one. It's a very cool one. And it's a very practical one. I think of all the tips that we've had today, this is, in a sense, the easiest because it's so practical. And the tip is basically as follows. It is, when somebody says something, repeat it back to them to check in and make sure that you understand what they're saying. Don't assume that you understood what they said. Allow them the honor of verifying that you got it by repeating it to them. Paraphrasing, repeating, and double-checking. This is something that's found today in active listening and listening techniques, but it's something that's very important from a Jewish perspective as well. In the story of King Solomon, when the two mothers came to King Solomon and said, hey, they were each fighting over a child. This is my child. No, this is my child. So before he rules on this case, and he said, we'll cut the child in half. And then one said, no, don't do it. So he said, oh, that's the mother. Before he issued his ruling, the first thing he says is, okay, let me get this straight. You're saying this is your child. And you're saying this is your child. Yes? And they said, yes. In Jewish law, this is written into Jewish law. If you're a judge, you cannot deliberate or rule on a case until you've checked in with each side to make sure that you understand their arguments. So wait, you're saying this? Yes, yes. You're saying this? Yes, yes. Why? Two reasons. Number one, it allows the litigants to feel confident that you understood their case or their claim. Number one. Number two, it allows the judge or the judges to make sure for themselves that they got it right before they begin to rule on the case or begin to deliberate a case. You have to make sure that you got it right. So the same thing is true in our private personal conversations. If somebody says something to you, it's good practice. It honors them to let them know that you're listening. They feel validated. When you check in with them, when you paraphrase and repeat back to them, it validates to them that you've listened, number one. And number two, it allows you to make sure you got it right. Before you begin reacting to what they said, you make sure that you got it right. We mentioned before about Moses. If Moses checked in, okay, so what you're saying is that you don't believe that God can take us into the land of Israel and you want to abandon ship. Is that what you're saying? They would have said, no, that's not what we're saying. But it would allow them the opportunity to clarify before getting the lecture about how what they're doing is incorrect. Right? Does this make sense? It's a very important step. Now, if we follow all of this, Oh, and let's read this on page 69, figure 2.5. So the listening impediment, the last one is rushing to respond. And the solution to that is paraphrase what I heard and attempt to clarify whether I've properly understood the speaker. This is very, very important because, again, it allows us to make sure that what we think we heard is what we're actually hearing. Because otherwise, how is it that we really know that is what the other person is saying? So now, based on all of these tips, and I'll summarize them quickly. Number one is value the person standing in front of you. If you're having a conversation with somebody, recognize that they have what to give. Number one. Number two, don't presume to know what they're saying based on their history or based on your history. Be open to the present and what they're saying in the now. Number three, don't be closed off to new information based on your own prejudices and biases. Don't be closed off to new information based on how you look at things and how you know things. Be open to new information. Number four, listen to the person and not just what they're saying. Try to understand where they're coming from and what they're really trying to say, as opposed to just sticking to the words that they're using. And number five, whenever you're in doubt, repeat the message back to them. Or even if you're not in doubt, repeat the message back to them and get feedback. Is this what you're saying? It honors them and it honors yourself to make sure you got it right. If the husband would have said, let me understand, is it one carton of milk and six eggs or six cartons of milk if there are eggs? The wife could have said, are you kidding me? No, the wife could have said, it was Meshuggah. What are you? Who would speak like that? What would the eggs have to do with six cartons of milk? Ah. No, but if the husband hears from his wife one carton of milk, and if they have eggs, get six, he would have said, wait, what am I getting? If he would have checked in or paraphrased what he thought that she was saying, then he could have gotten it right. But he didn't, so he got it wrong. Let's get back to our opening case, and let's see how things could be different if they implement the tips from this class. Here we go.
Remember Judy and Michael? We watched a brief video of their exchange earlier in the lesson. Here's how the scenario might play out if Michael applied the listening skills we had just discussed. Michael arrives home late after a long day at work. Judy comments,
wow, it's late.
Late?
Well, it's not late for you, honey. You always finish work at this time. But it's late for me.
It's late for you?
Yes. Because I really enjoy your company and keep glancing at the clock to see if it's time for you to walk in the door.
I know what you mean. I also can't wait to get home.
Now that's a far-fetched exchange, isn't it? A blessed combination of patience and a mutual pursuit of clarification.
How easy life is in the old JLive video. Now, if you're wondering, if you're thinking, yeah, but it's harder than it looks, right? I mean, that's like amazing. That's a wonderful conversation. He repeated back. She says, you're late. All he says is, late? And she says, yeah, well, I miss you. Whatever. I forgot to read. But it was perfectly scripted. If you want, you let JLI headquarters in Brooklyn know. They'll script out your life. So next time you have a conversation, maybe they'll even produce a video for you. And it'll be they'll get it done super fast. No, but life is not as easy as a 90-second video. But there are very important tips today. Number one, don't presume. Well, without not really going in order of what we just, because I already wrapped it up. But don't presume the worst. Be open to hearing what they're saying. Honor them. Ask questions. Be attentive. And it brings out the best as opposed to just creating the conflict and the standoff. Thank you very much for joining me today for lesson two of Communication. It's Art and Soul.